This is one of the, for me, one of my favorite slides, because it basically really clearly shows what we don't have today. By the way, I'm going to present, which is the Open Web Application Security Project. And I found it absolutely ironic that I know more about an orange juice that I buy, right, than the software that we run on our machines and the software that run our critical infrastructure. And a lot of part of the problem is visibility. I really believe that at the moment, it doesn't make commercial sense to write secure software unless you're being attacked and your clients are complaining. Now, I know a lot of people don't like to hear this, but I get exposed to a lot of customers, I show them a lot of problems, and I have to tell you that their priority is not fixing the vulnerabilities that I present. So part of the reason is this, it doesn't make business sense, right? This is a business. Most companies are not in the business of writing secure software. They are in the business of making money or providing some service. Doesn't mean that they create insecure software, you know, on purpose. It just means that because their clients don't demand or don't pay for it, they don't really care. So I love this image. And basically, OWASP is trying to help. A great concept for OWASP was that we're going to bring visibility. You know, OWASP is all about making security visible. So I don't have any problems people making a decision, say, I'm not going to fix this, I want to fix this, or I don't care about this problem, which basically are risk decisions. I have a problem when they don't know the risk that they're taking. So I think that if you make things visible and open, things sort of will tend to correct themselves. Now, one of the things I like to always talk about is my case study, because I think that I am a success story from OWASP, because I have put a lot into OWASP. I don't get directly paid by OWASP. So, you know, a lot of people think that the people on the OWASP board, which I'm part, are paid fees. No, we don't. We don't get it. It's all on our own time or some of our employees' time that they accept we to spend time on it. So I love a scene from Monty Python, if you know that, where the guy says, you know, what have the Romans ever did for us? And then it keeps going on forever. So this is a bit like, what has OWASP ever done for me? Right, it gives me a great community of like-minded individuals. It gives me a lot of very good friends, and you know, it's amazing how when you meet people in this kind of open environment, you actually make some very good friendships. Give me a lot of knowledge. Give me a place to dump my research. Give me a lot of speaking slots at conferences. So it's great because you get a lot of exposure. You know, people actually think that you know what you're talking about when you present something. So that, you know, that helps me a lot, and actually has generated 100% of my contract work for the last 3 years. I'm a contractor. I'm an independent contractor. I have my own limited company. You know, if you guys have very interesting projects and you can pay my daily rate and I'm interested and I have time, I can do it. Right? I'm still independent. Although I'm going to present some stuff for one of my main contracts, I really value my independence. And being independent, it's really good to be in a position where your employees or your people giving you a contract are trying to convince you that you want to work for them. So my last major contracts, and this I just want to explain my model, is the current contracting model that I came up with was I negotiate a 20-day contract with one company, but I do it in a way where I says I'm only going to commit to 10 days a month. And every month, I, not you, my customer, will decide how many days I'll do. So I get the best of both worlds. I get a full-time permanent commitment, and I get flexibility that when I get a cool project, I can say, yeah, I can allocate 10 days for you in a couple of months' time. Works really well. Of course, only works if the employee wants you too, right? Because, you know, of course, they, you know, let's just say that usually the first couple of contract negotiations, a lot of ink goes through the contracts until they actually accept it. So, you know, when I did my last one with Ounce Labs, it was part of the negotiation was, can we actually work together? So it was not about, you know, I having the technical skills or they having a problem with my daily rate. It was more, we want you, you know, let's see if we can work together. And, you know, just to say that it's a great place to be if you're negotiating a contract. And OWASP gave me that. So, you know, it's about OWASP, it's about open source, non-profit, charitable foundation, which basically enable organizations so they can develop, maintain, and acquire software they can trust. I love the fact that today we can't do that. We can't develop, we can't maintain, and we can't acquire software that I can actually trust that will do what it's supposed to do. So the whole key is making security visible, and we do by documentation, tools, working groups, security community, and awareness. So OWASP is basically a community like you guys. It's a worldwide community of people who care about security. We're sort of quite anti-vendor, not in a kind of bashing the vendor way. Moreover, this is not a place to show marketing BS. And actually, most vendors, you know, just about everybody that works in OWASP, right, contributes, works for a vendor or an open source product, right? But the whole idea is that you can come and show the research you're doing. That might be tied up if you're a web application firewall vendor, or if you're a scanner, or if you are writing some pen testing or work for a pen testing company. But it's all about sharing knowledge. It's all about, you know, promoting and improving, you know, the web application security world. And so basically, the principles of OWASP is all products and documents have to be free and open, which basically means the application security knowledge should be freely available. We encourage awareness, discussion, and best practices. I actually have, that was a copy and paste slide, though. This is the one, right? So what's unique about OWASP is everything we do is open, right? It's literally, I like to think that it's kind of the new generation of open source kind of organizations, because we don't really talk about the openness, right? It's like, it's open, it's a given, it's not about a religious thing, it's about sharing information, and we try to work to the next levels. Like, everything's open, everything is thing, that's the rules of engagement. If you like it, let's work together. But we also try to make it into an economic model that makes sense. Because ultimately, right, although I believe that everything should be open, I don't like the fact that I do something based on somebody else's knowledge and then I have to lock it, you know, for some arbitrary reason, right? I like my knowledge to be exposed so I can learn. I don't think that it will work unless there's a viable economic model. Because knowledge, unfortunately, is actually, today what costs money is people's time. So unless you actually have funds available to pay for people's time and people's commitment, it won't work. You know, you have this open source typical problem where, you know, you need a cosmical sequence of events for actually somebody deliver something in time. Or you need a hell of an organization. And to be honest, you can almost count in one hand the people who actually done it successfully. You know, OpenBSD have done it. You know, Linux has done it. Apache has done it. The JBoss, but that's a bit different. You know, but there's not Firefox. But there's not a lot of real models and case studies of actually organizations who have consistently deliver high-valued solutions on an open-source way. So I really believe in open source. I still think there's a lot of work to be done on a commercial model of open-source kind of world. And I think OWASP is in the middle of that, because OWASP is actually quite profitable. We are a charity, so that means that there's no profit distribution, but we are quite profitable. To be honest, we're now sitting, and I'll show in a bit, on, you know, at least $200,000 that we can actually, if you don't do anything, we'll be still there by the end of the year, even if you pay all our expenses. And that's not even assuming that we're going to make any money, which we will, with the conferences that we still have. So our problem with OWASP at the moment is not money, it's actually what to do with it. Which, you know, it's a weird problem to have, but that's actually where we are now. So OWASP has a massive body of knowledge. You've probably seen the books we have there. And the whole idea is that we got a community, we got our projects, our chapters, we got our the conference we do, and sort of, you know, goes around that kind of circle of verifying security, manage, and slides will be available for you guys to have a look at. And it's all about, you know, it basically in some ways it's everything to do with application security. You know, it's all about sharing information and making sure everything, you know, people understand, you know, the implications and raise the level of knowledge. So these are all our chapters. We basically have chapters around the world. OWASP is very empowering. So if you come to me and says, well, you can't start a chapter in Poland because there's already one here, but if you want to start a chapter, or at least one in Krakow, or if you want to start one in Warsaw, or you want to start one anywhere, all it takes is for you to say, I'm going to do it. And then you can start one. So it's really empowering. There's no barriers of entry. You know, there's no, exclusions for anybody. So that's all the chapters we have around the world. And it's a pretty interesting thing. And here's the one from Poland, right? Actually, you know, the guys from Confidence actually helped to organize that. And that's the one here. So please participate and work with it. So I'm not going to do this demo, because I don't have time. I want to show some more stuff. So usually I would actually go and deface the OWASP website just to show that it can be done. Because the OWASP website is a wiki. It's like Wikipedia, right? Everything that can be changed. Again, the model is you want to start a project. You don't tell me you're going to start a project. You go to the OWASP website and you start a page with your project. Right? Which works really well because suddenly, you know, there's no bottleneck. And Paulo, which is somewhere here. Where's Paulo? Hey, there's Paulo. Paulo is actually the guy who's trying to sort out all the mess of the projects, because we have literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of projects now, which we're going to really bring on the quality and create standards for what we mean by release quality, beta quality, etc. So the top 10, which I highly recommend you guys have a look, is the top 10 vulnerabilities that we sort of define for web applications. If you haven't read it, you absolutely should read it. It's probably the most famous thing that OWASP has done. It is referenced by PCI, by several governments actually, or a lot of companies use it internally. So it's about, if you're doing any kind of web work, you should read this, because most likely, if you're not aware, you're going to be vulnerable. So these are our books. This was a great experiment that worked really well. So now we are a publisher, and a publishing means that we can upload a PDF, select the cover, and have a book. And the prices are actually pretty good. All, you know, the a 400-page book costs $14, 40, you know, Polish, you know, currency. So it's actually very, very acceptable. And we actually publish all these books, right? I literally created all this before the last conference. Because what happens was I created the first one, we ordered 300, I pray that actually they turn up okay, right? They did, and then I had like 2 days before the conference, so I created all the other ones, like, you know, in between, you know, the parties. And basically, some interesting growth stats, right? You know, a year and a half ago, we had 75 local chapters, 15 company sponsors, about 100,000 80, and we have about $80,000 in the bank. Now, May 2007, we have more chapters. We start to have more individual members and education corporate memberships, and I'll show what it means. And what's interesting about those members is that they don't get anything from being a member that you don't get already as an individual of the public. So there's nothing that those guys have that you don't have already. So it's an interesting model, because when we talk about how do you make the business case for OWASP membership, it's like, well, there's nothing they get more, but they support OWASP. So we started to have a good case where, look, if you give us money, OWASP can actually make a very good use of it. So we can make more with your money than probably you can yourself. And that's starting to work with some companies and individuals. But it's a great, interesting business case, because the key is there's nothing locked. There's nothing that the member will give you, you know, that you don't get already. So at the moment, we have $420,000 in the bank, right? We already committed $100,000 to the Summer of Code, which Paulo is running, and let's say another $100,000 to pay Paulo, which is actually there's only three OWASP employees, so he's one of them. So even if we don't make any more money until the end of the year, we're still going to end up in the end of the year with $200,000. Most likely, we're going to end up with $500,000, because we still have the conferences, we have memberships being renewed. So if you have any ideas how to spend this money, talk to me. Right? It's true. You know, my title is the chief OWASP evangelist, which I don't like, but basically allows me to come up with ideas, right? To spend stuff and promote things. So I'm all about making connections. That's what I want to do. So if you have an idea, like we talked to Petkov yesterday, of a job board, right? It's not about making money. It's not about charging it. It's about making something valuable to OWASP members and OWASP community. The game of the game for OWASP is the more value we add, the more the business case exists for being members. So this is the current structure of OWASP. It's very flat. There is the board, which is me, Jeff, Dave, Tom, and Sebastian. And the reason, right, Tom and Sebastian are there, because the board before was Jeff, me, Def, Jeff, Dave, and Andrew, was because Sebastian and Tom are the other two major active players. So there is really a case that if you start involved today with OWASP, and in next year is one of the most active guys, you might end up on the board. And to be honest, the board power is not a lot, right? The power that the board has is the financials, so we can allocate where the money goes. We have leadership assignments, fair enough. We agree on the conference locations. We monitor the wiki homepage, so we're not going to publish the wiki homepage password, admin password, right? So a little bit of limit on the openness of OWASP and our bank account details. So we're also not going to publish our bank account details, right? So but apart from that, you know, everything else is soft power. We'll have it until we screw up, which is sometimes is quite damaging or quite worrying, because a lot of people use OWASP as a standard. And we're like, OWASP is not a standard. We don't create standards because we don't have the quality control, but everybody uses it as a standard. And it keeps growing. And sometimes we just feel that we're going on this massive train that we sort of try to keep it on board, but we don't, you know, the control is quite, it's very community driven. So this is the current OWASP employees. These are the guys who actually get paid to work on OWASP. So again, if you want to work at OWASP and you find a place where you want to add a lot of value, we actually can have funds to pay you, right? So we got Paulo, we got Allison, who now is only 2 days a week, and got Caden, who just started. And again, the idea is that to beef a lot on project management and administration. So this is how OWASP works, right? Do you have a project on XYZ at OWASP? That's somebody asking me. My answer can be no, but do you want to do it, right? Why don't you do XYZ at OWASP? Well, there's nobody allocated to do it. Do you want to do it, right? Is there an OWASP chapter XYZ? Well, no. Do you want to start one, right? The project chapter XYZ is dead. Great. Do you want to take over it? And, you know, I want to start a project XYZ. What happens next? Well, read the new project guidelines, create a wiki page, and contact Polo. I love this because basically everybody that comes by to complain, I go, hey, do something about it. All right, that's what I did. That's where I am here today. I know there was a problem on the .NET side of things. I did something about it. I got involved. I'm here today. So it's all about empowerment. There's no, you know, I one of my favorite conversations was with Petko, right, about a year ago, where he was like, what's the catch? Like, there must be a catch. Like, what's the catch? This sounds too good to be true. Where is the conspiracy, right? And, you know, I'm in the middle of it. I don't see one, right? You know, there might be one, but I don't see it. So I think it is really like that. If you are very involved, but if you just say ideas and you don't contribute, you'll find yourself very, very ignored because we don't have time for people who says, what about this? And then they don't do anything about it. So very quickly, we did the Spring of Code. This was actually, that's wrong. It's actually 31 projects. This is actually the wrong slide. Oh, that's correct. That's the Spring of Code. That's the one I want to show. The Summer of Code 2008, which we just finished, we did 31 grants of application security researchers. That was part of the Summer of Code. That was one of the ways we found to distribute money, which was to basically say, you know, kind of ripped off Google's idea, was that, hey, let's pay people to work on projects. So basically, what we did was we're now allocating, in this case, $104,000 to 31 projects to work on OWASP-related stuff. And again, I actually said it, because I'm the guy who helped organize it, and Paul is implementing, that both from the Spring of Code and the Summer of Code, we actually allocated 100% of the proposals that we received. So actually, I feel we didn't receive enough proposals, because I was able to slice it up in $5,000 and $2,500 sponsorships, and everybody says, I'm cool with the way you broke it. So, you know, it's actually weird. You know, we actually have more money to give sponsorships with, but we don't have enough applications. But we can actually say that OWASP is actually allocating $250,000 on actually open source projects. And in fact, the books you get outside was directly generated from the Spring of Code. Now that's our books. Right? Where's my books thing? Okay, I'll show that in a second. This was an idea that I had in San Jose, which has basically who has had no momentum. So, but I'm still pitching it. And again, if you guys want an area that there's a lot of interesting opportunities, I would focus on this. The idea is to create almost like horizontal. If you think that OWASP has all the projects, horizontal working groups that focus on a particular thing. So we have, if you look at browser security, that touches on a lot of things. It touches on a lot of OWASP projects. Every single one of those are things that, if you're an industry, you know, a company in industry, a bank or a financial institution or a government, at the moment, there's not an easy way to talk to OWASP because we have a lot of projects, but we don't have focus on specific things. So the idea is to create working groups of people come together. You know, it's a bit like getting, you know, browser security. You get, you know, Petko, you get RSnake, you get a couple of other guys, you get Microsoft, you get Firefox, you get the Apple guys on the same room, right? Put somebody in there so nobody kills each other and says, you guys have a week, right? Or you have to come up with a document in 6 months' time or 2 months' time about the next generation of browser security, which would be really useful. So I really think this is important. It has no momentum at the moment, so if you guys want to help, it'd be really, really great. Now, that's our membership, so basically that's the membership things. So you can see that again, you know, people can, you know, does this, but actually we're actually preparing some member packs for them. This is our current corporate members. And remember that these guys don't get anything that they don't get that already. So it's quite interesting that we actually have all these corporate members, and they pay from $3,000 to $9,000. So this is one idea I had last time we did, which we're actually giving $1,000 and no string attached to these open source projects, because we on last conference we did a quick pool, and these are the ones that people use: Nmap, Mod Security, Firebug, Burp, Nitco, Extract, Temper Data, Web Developer, ACGI, Find Bugs. Now, a quick thing: who from here, right, uses at least one of these, right, in their thing? All right, so who doesn't use at least one of these, right? So it should be the other guys, right, or the guys who do you want to commit. What I like about this is I want you to calculate what's your degree of ownage. Basically, the question you want to ask, if there's a backdoor in one of those, right, how many times you're going to be owned? Because the reality is there's just about nobody looking at the source code of those things, right? And even if there is today, there's no guarantee there's one tomorrow, right? So what I want to do next is I want to say, the next round, I said, hey, here's $10,000. Can we get some serious guys to actually review this thing and produce a report? Because I think a lot of people in our industry would actually be quite useful for it. So again, we're giving this that. Paulo's organizing it in all his free time. And you do that. So please help us grow, right? It's all, you know, we have the chapter leaders, project leaders, all that stuff. And basically, how much time do I have? Okay, so I have 20 minutes. So any questions on OWASP quickly before I move to the next one? No? Okay. So what I want to talk about now is I want to do a quick presentation. And I think this is going to not work, but because I think the resolution, okay, this resolution is actually going to, yeah, that's going to be nice. Okay, but do you know if I increase the resolution, is it actually going to work? Yeah, let's try that. Okay, so what I want to talk about now, first of all, a big disclaimer, right? What I'm going to talk about now has nothing to do with the company that I'm doing the research for. Okay, what I mean is related to it, but this is not their official position. This is not, okay, that's good, that's better, isn't it? And basically, this is my interpretation of their world. So, you know, if I say something which is highly politically incorrect, it's my fault, not these guys. Let's see if this works. No. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry. 120. Okay. Should we make it 100? Okay. Well, like that. Okay. All right. Cool. Should I go to 60? Okay. That's cool. All right. So again, you know, like, because I don't know how many guys here actually do. You know, security assessments, pen testing, source code review, you know, actually is involved in doing application security. Yeah, so almost should be some of you, right, who actually care about code. So basically, Ounce Labs, which is the competitors of Fortify and Coverity, so if you're looking at the source code scanning space, you need to evaluate these guys. And there's a third company from Taiwan, I can't remember the name, but they're also good guys in the space. And there is some open source tools from OWASP, and there's Findbox. But really, I have to say that, unfortunately, there is no open source alternative with the technology that currently Ounce and Fortify have. So one of my contracts, I'm not an employee, right? I'm not on a full-time staff. I have my 20-day, 10-day kind of split with these guys, with Ounce Labs. My job is to use this in commercial engagements. So my job is not to give this to the people who get a lot of value out of it by pressing a button and getting results. My job is to actually get this to be used by the security professionals who currently don't use, right? So basically, just very, very quickly, the way this works is you scan an app, right? You basically have a bunch of findings. It breaks into high vulnerabilities, whatever, right? And basically, the whole concept of these tools is that they follow tainted data. So what I mean by tainted data means is that they follow, well, let me get a fucking better example, wait. They follow malicious data as it enters the system. So the big difference is that if you have something like Findbugs or you know, your favorite grep or regex, you are finding instances of particular dangerous features, right? If you analyze the code, you might even find call paths between A and B. What both Ounce and Fortify do is they follow tainted data. So they go, here's a get parameter which gets data from the outside. I'm now going to track every single string allocation of this until it gets to what's called a sync, for example, an execute query. So this is very powerful because this is not about there is a path between A to B. There's a path between A to B that is exploitable. So it's really powerful, and it really makes a big difference when you're looking at stuff, right? And basically, what's it called? So you can follow you on the source code, and you know, and you can basically see the vulnerability occurring until you end up on the append. There you go, there's the vulnerability, there's my SQL injection there, right? And then here is my execute statement. So here we go. So there's my execute statement that is actually going to execute my get, you know, my create statement S, which my tainted data there, right? So this is very good, you know, and works, you know, for a lot of people it works really well. That's why Fortify announced sell a lot of, you know, product, but there is a lot of limitations on the technology because it really depends on you actually using the technology that the tool was designed for. Because ultimately, it all depends on the mappings. So if the tool doesn't understand that you completely create an abstraction layer for get parameter, the tool is not going to find tainted data starting from there. So what I did, right, in my Ounce time was I built a new application on top of Ounce's technology. So what I did was, and I called it F1, and sorry, like the thing is a little bit off because I don't usually work on this resolution, right? Let me just. But what this is, and the reason I want to show this is because what I do in F1, it's not just the technology, it's the approach, and it's the whole concept of if you're going to analyze code, you need to script. You need to be able to script the way you think. Right, so you need to be able to say, I want to follow this, and I want to follow that, and what happens if I do this, what happens if I do that? And that's a very powerful way of doing that. So for example, in F1, I was able to rewrite a lot of the built-in functionality to give me access to the backend. So let me show you, for example, actually, if I open this up again, probably going to do it. So what I did with F1 to in some ways was highly politically incorrect, right? These guys have a product and they have a GUI. And what I did was, well, I can't get what I want out of that GUI, I'm gonna write a new one. But it was a massive bet that paid off because I was able to add features to my GUI that don't exist on the product. And I also was able to solve my immediate problem, which was there is no point of me going to the product team saying, I need this feature, because it's going to take them 6 months or at least 2 months to add to the product. Because anything that goes into the main product has to be tested, has to be, you know, bulletproof, has, you know, I like that. I like that there is a quality control. My problem is I'm in the middle of a client engagement with, 500,000 lines of code ahead of me, and I need that solution. I can't wait 2 hours, might as well, 6 months. So this allows me to do what I need to do, code if I need to in whatever language I want, and then go to the product team and going, hey, this is what you guys need to add to the product. So the idea is that in the next version of Ounce, which is gonna come up in a couple of months' time, there's already features in there that came from the first version of F1 when I show them. And F1 is about, I might not be able to use the name, but it was all about Formula One. So you have the normal cars, and you have the Formula One car. Now, most people can't drive a Formula One car because they don't know how to. But if you learn how to drive it, you can go really, really fast. And that's basically what this is. This tool is not for the faint of hearts, right? It's really geeky, but it's super powerful. I have to say that for the first time, I have a tool that matches the speed that I'm thinking. I can actually say, I want to do this, and I can script it, which for me was like a major breakthrough, right? So for example, like just a couple little things. We're now going to see the same thing that I was showing before in WebGoat, but on different view. And again, like the way I did this was like I literally, and this is why the GUI sucks, is because I literally was, hey, I need a way to see all the smart traces. I add a button to it. Hey, I need a way to see all the lost things. I add a button to it. So it was literally like as I was doing the engagements, I was adding the features that I needed to solve my problems, which I have to say was actually pretty efficient. Because it allowed me to do really cool stuff. So I can say, here's the same kind of flow graph, and I'm now playing with, for example, complete different ways of displaying it. So I can see all the parameters, I can see all the packages, right? I can basically start modeling around, I can see the context, I can see the source code. So for example, right, although the Ounce graph is pretty cool, I prefer to read this one. I don't know if you guys can see, but I'm actually seeing the flow of data from there to there to there. No, sorry, from there, one, there you go, that goes like this, right? And I can see the path. And then I can go things like, oh, actually, I want to see more than one. So I can go like this. So a lot of these features are the typical really easy features that's going to take you half an hour to implement. But if you actually want to add that thing to the product, it's going to take them 2 months, right, to actually do it. So this I found is really, really powerful. Because then again, you know, I can select, I can literally have direct access to the Ounce backend. So this is now a way where I can just mark all these methods and then rerun the scans. So I sort of have the best of both worlds. And the thing that really, from my point of view, excites me is that not just now I have full access to the answers, to the findings, I have access to something which I found even more exciting, which is basically, right, an XML version of the code. So what I'm actually going to show you here is a graphical representation already of the of all the code that exists in of all the code. Is that the correct one? I think it's this one. Yeah, that's the one. So what you guys have here, right, is a graphical programmatically access to the actual source code. So I can grab a JSP, and I can see which class is subclassed. I can grab a particular class, so a function, I can see who it calls, and then I can also have added the cross checks on the other side, so I can actually see who calls it. So here's an example of a function, right, that goes get roles, I know this calls that guy, and I know it's called by that guy. This is just this answers the same question that I have every single time I see a method, which is who calls this? Like, you know, and for example, if you're looking at authorization stuff, that's one of the biggest questions you want to ask. Okay, which web control calls the is authenticated? Because it's the ones that actually don't that I'm interested in. So this allows me to have programmatic control, and I can do all sorts of crazy filters. I can say, give me all the setters, and actually give me all the setters that have a string on it, and now I have all my setters with a string on it. Now I can select them all, I can mark them as syncs, and I can run the Ounce scan. So suddenly, right, I can go, hey, I want to monitor all of this, so I'm going to tell the Ounce, I call the taintometer. It's like, I'm going to taint all these methods, and then run the engine, and let Ounce tell me where they end up with. Instead of actually now manually going and following every single one of those boys to figure out where they end up. So there's really a lot of cool features in here. There's a lot of good stuff. Even from a pure technology, right? There's, you know, even things like workflow. So I've implemented the workflow using the Windows, the Microsoft Workflow Foundation. So I can actually define a workflow, right, to do a particular task. I can edit my workflow. I can edit my source code of my workflow within F1, right? And I can execute it using dynamic parameters, which basically get loaded based on the properties that exist here. So what I view when I look at this, I see this is how I want to work. My logic is a workflow. When I find a vulnerability, I want to be able to define a workflow that says, this is how I found it. I look at that XML file. The XML file told me where the beans were. I looked at the beans. Then I had to get all the ones that overwrite this thing. Then I had to scan them. And I had to look the results. And I filter them. And bang, there's my vulnerabilities. And what's cool about this is that once you figure out the formula, you can do it across the board. Because the way I use this, and this is the final key point I want to make, is that it does in my world, the best model is when you have a black box and a white box combined with a tool and a knowledgeable person in front of it. So what you do, what you want, I always ask when I'm doing these tests for the application, because that allows me to find a problem, go to the app, test it. If it works, great. I have a path I can search. If it doesn't work, it's like, why didn't it work? Because the code is vulnerable. There's something else in there. Then you look what made it not work, and then you figure out the blind spots. So usually what happens is there's a patch that prevents some type of exploits to work, but there's a blind spot in the patch. So then you figure that out. So I call it like a pen test, a source code driven pen test, or a white box pen test, or a white box, whatever you want to call it. But I'm not going to do one more pure black box or pure source code manual assessment in my life, because it's so unproductive when you can do things like this. When you can basically say, hey, you know, look at this, find this stuff for me, get me all the data, I got the formula, run me again, tell me all the other variations. And also, like, to fix this, right? The advantage is that I can go to a developer and say, hey, here are 1,000 cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, and they all created on that function. So actually, if you fix that function, you're actually going to address your problem. Or your authorization model or input validation model is completely screwed up. You need to do it again, right? There's no way you're going to patch this properly. It's going to be more expensive for you to patch the 1,000 cases than to write a better one from scratch. So suddenly, you don't have that problem with pen testing, which is you find 50 problems, you got bored after that, or you don't have time to find the 1,000. You give them the findings, and although you wrote, this is a sample of a systemic problem, they only fix the 50 problems you told them to. So they don't actually fix the problem, they fix your exploits, which is really frustrating from a kind of web application point of view. So the concept that I have here is that it's like this allows me to script the way I want to work on. Because actually, the other thing that I want to just quickly show is that a lot of these features are actually driven by this command, by basically, what's it called? By scripts. And again, another very cool feature that I wish every application had was this little command prompt, which, and for example, you know, that's my user custom script to do my searches. So I actually code a lot of my functionality because I now have objects that have all the findings. I have an object that has all the serialized source code. And I have objects who have all the information on the file system. So suddenly you can script your thinking. You can go for every finding that has this, for everything that has that, do me a search, and it works really, really well. But one of the last features that I want to show you guys, and I think I'm running out of time, and I wish every application had this. And this came from one of the questions that when they asked guys, when I was talking about what I wanted before I wrote this, it says, okay, Dennis, let me see if I understand. What do you want us to expose? So this was the core team, right? This was the guys who write the core analysis engine. They're like, what do you want us to expand, right? And I said, I want everything. And they're like, what do you mean by everything? I says, I want to have programmatic access to every single API and method that exists in your organization, because that is the only way that I can do what I need to do when I need when I have a requirement. So let me give you an example. When I was doing an assessment last week, right, I basically was doing dumps of the data of the model, and we generated 160 gigabytes of data, right? A little bit. Now, what was really annoying is that there was a bug on the parsing engine that was putting those XML files a character that was illegal. So I had to write a little script, right, to fix that and then load it. So instead of loading a file in 1 second, I was loading in 5 seconds. But when you're talking about 160 gigs, that makes a massive difference. So it took 9 hours, and it could have taken 5 hours to parse it all. So by having internal access to the APIs, you can fix things really, really easy. You can go straight access to it. You can patch it. And it's not that I want to change the source code. I just want to hook everywhere. So if you look at F1, right, I have a method here where I call, this is the APIs of F1, right? So what you have here is the internal APIs of F1, which I expose, and I can dynamically invoke. So I can come here and I go, I'm going to write a debug message so I can find my debug, right? Here's my debug. I write something, and now it's there, right? If I want to send an error message, I go there, and it's there, right? And that's the internal APIs of F1. So everything here is completely invocable, right? So you can see here, for example, that I have a case where, let's say, I have, you can see that create second project, right? So I'm going to create something here which go public static void hello confidence, right? And basically I'm just going to go debug message dot debug, and I go hello. In fact, I'm also going to return that as a string, so you can see that. So that's hello, and then I'm going to do and okay, so I try to compile it, we get an error, okay, cool, right? And then I'm gonna go return, done. So I'm running a little script, I compile it, it's available for me, I can invoke it, done, right? And it's there, hello. So I have full access. Now what's cool about this is now I can invoke it from my command prompt. So you can see it's mish tests. I put that in a global variable, mish tests, there you go. And I'm gonna go hello confidence, oops, sorry. And I go it's a variable, mish test, hello confidence, executed again, right? It's executed, done, see? There you go. So if you kind of check, and now let's say we want to pass a string to it, blah, blah, blah. I can go string plus hello. Now, if you look here, now I have dynamically added a string, so now I need to add a value there, executed, and the return address don't have that, so let's just do that there for the done. Plus AAA, compile it, and there's an error. Of course, it needs a plus, compile source code, and now I can execute it. I can go like that, and there you go. That's there, right? And basically, of course, sorry. That's a bit stupid. There you go. That's why it's doing that. Compile source code, execute it, and now it's there. And now if I execute it from here, again, you can see that now I need to pass my string here. I go like this, and I execute it, and it's there. Now, the power of this is I now can script everything. Now, if the tool has a function which is create a particular file with a particular filter, it takes me one line of code to add that. And now if I need to do some massaging on the files because there was a problem or I need to do certain analysis, I can script that. So I wish that every app that I had gave me that little command prompt, that little internal access where when you basically go fire the IntelliSense, you have access to all the internal methods of the application and all the internal classes. Right? And that for me is part of the reason why I went out of my way to write F1, because I was writing all these little tools and then I realized, you know what, I might as well create a little environment for me because I think I'm going to be writing these little tools for a long time, right? And it's not just that, you know, my argument to the Ounce guys is that we should be able to scan everything. You know, we should be able to scan Klingon, right? We should be able to scan whatever you want. All I need is a parser, right? And something that tells me what the problems are, and I can scan the whole world, you know, I can scan anything. At the moment, the languages are limited by what parsers you have, so this allows you to have a huge amount of speed. And when you look at custom code and custom apps, you're screwed, because they're not being written in Java, or if they're written in Java, they have their own platforms, their own ways, and you almost need to have a custom parser to handle whatever the guys are doing with it. So, you know, like, the world of software is really, really complex, and and this at least gives me kind of window to that world. So I think I ran out of time. I'll be available if you have any questions, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. So thank you.